This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Good Things on the Bigger Picture, the show where we speak to good people doing good things. Back in 1987, Meenakshi Raman was among those detained under Ops Lalang. Spending 47 days in solitary confinement, Meena was never charged with anything, though at the time, this young lawyer had been working on several public interest cases, including the infamous Asia Rare Earth case. The experience strengthened her convictions, and Meena has continued to work on issues relating to the environment, social justice, development, developing countries and North-South affairs through Sahabat Alam Malaysia, which she is president of, and also through their sister organizations, the Third World Network, where she's head of programs, and the Consumers Association of Penang. So today she joins me to share why she eschewed a corporate life and instead took a road less traveled, fighting to help the poor and underserved. Welcome, Meena. How are you today?
I'm good, Juliet. Always nice to speak to you.
Yes, so we are. So this has been like a secret plan for a long time. Not so secret plan on my part. You know, I always speak to you on Earth Matters and there were tackling issues, but I've always wanted to talk to you about your life as an activist and how you got into all of this. So thank you so much, you know, for speaking with me today on Good Things. So take me back to the start, Meena. You know, what led you to, you are, of course, a trained lawyer. You know, what led you to pursuing law and becoming interested in these sorts of issues surrounding social justice, environment, and all of that?
Well, first of all, I think I must attribute my own path to actually my parents, both of whom who have actually passed on. Mm-hmm. My father was a veterinarian in a veterinary department, lower middle income household, six siblings. So there's a lot on my father's hands. Mm-hmm. But one thing they always stressed was education, and that was very important to them. And we were a very religious family, meaning not the ritual religious, but more in terms of values. They taught us that, you know, good values and so on. So much of that, you know, early imbibing of these good values about how we should actually work with communities and the poor and the downtrodden was something that I was involved with as I was growing up. Mm-hmm. But it was seen more in the context of charity, you know, how we usually say, you know, you have to do charity and do good to others. But it wasn't so much about really looking at social justice as a systemic issue and then asking the question of whether we want to dedicate our lives in the cause of social justice. So in the beginning years, it was more about, oh, I should get a decent job and then I would do charity by giving donations or whatever. But that changed because of, why did I do law? Well, my Form 6 teachers said that I like to talk a lot. So they said, oh, you might make a good lawyer. And probably it was the gift of the gap that got me there.
Hey, they were right, okay?
Yeah, and then I think in law school, I think the change really happened in law school because I don't know whether Yoke Ling, who you spoke to earlier, told you we were actually in the same law school where Sulaiman Abdullah, who was famous, and he was defense counsel for Anwar Ibrahim years ago. So anyway, he was very involved with the Consumers Association of Penang. And then he was also teaching in the law school as a law lecturer. Mm-hmm. And then he started a course on law and consumer law and environmental law. And he just opened our minds because he said, you know, you people mark your students' thesis, you know, and then he will get us to debate a whole load of things, make us read and think out of the box. So it actually changed the way in which we thought in relation to education. I think this, a lot, if you look at many of us and how our direction and our lives changed, it really has to do with our teachers to start with. And I think one of the things that really blew my mind was when we visited as students to the Consumers Association of Penang. Mm-hmm. We went to look at communities who were affected. And this was Penang late 70s and early 80s, mm-hmm. Where it was about Penang just developing and, you know, industrializing very fast, the free trade zones and so on. So we saw how pollution was affecting fishermen at that time who had their fish destroyed completely. And then you have a cattle rearer who had no grazing ground for his cattle, but the airport was expanding.
Yeah.
Traditional communities who were making boats and ships who were thrown out of their land because of coastal development. So it began to question in us, who is this development for? What is this development about? And who does it benefit? Mm-hmm. So we began to look at very deep questions like that. And we were asking questions about, the development pathway. What actually leads to this? Who is behind this? And why? And then these communities look at us and say, you're a lawyer. Can you please advise me about my rights? And then, I used to scratch my head and said, oh, they never taught this in law school. So it made the legal education really even more exciting because it was connected to real life issues. And then, of course, as they would say, the rest was history, because really had a deep, discussion and soul searching in my own self together with my other colleagues. And we felt that, either you are part of the problem or you're part of the solution. So I want to be part of the solution. And that was when the Consumers Association of Penang agreed to support us in the setting up of the first public interest, full public interest law firm. And that started our journey to public interest law and environmental law. Mm-hmm. So that was like in 1982, 83, when my colleague and I graduated after that. And then we just went on to take on all these big cases. And till today, still at it.
Still at it, yeah, 40 years later. And it doesn't seem to be ending, does it, Mina? I mean, the question of like, who is this development for? I mean, these are the conversations we have all the time. Bottom line, always you come to, a lot of it is fueled by greed, isn't it?
Totally. And I think that, over the years, of course, at least the environmental discourse is much more pronounced. Mm. At the early years, there wasn't even proper laws in this country. For instance, you mentioned the Asian rare earth case.
Yeah.
I constantly refer to that as the Erin Brockovich case of Malaysia.
Yeah.
Because it was about this multinational Mitsubishi Chemicals of Japan in joint venture with a Chinese company in Bukit Merah, Ipoh, when they were mining the tin tailings and there were radioactive waste was actually produced, and then they were dumping it and so on and so forth. And then, we as young lawyers had to go on the ground and start, very much like the Erin Brockovich.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm Erin Brockovich, but...
But similarities.
Working with the communities who were wonderful. They were the women in that community is a Chinese New Village. Just across the road, there was this Chinese New Village. We started actually seeing mothers, young mothers miscarrying at very young age. We started seeing lead in the blood of children because we were told by our scientist experts who actually were from foreign countries who came to help us with this case. We had a wonderful Canadian nun who was herself, an expert on radiation and its effects. And she said, you don't wait for cancers to happen because cancers take a while. You should start looking at the lead because lead also is there in the waste. So start looking at that. And we found blood lead levels elevated. And together with a doctor who was helping us with this, went around taking radiation readings. And all that, and we were just astounded by the cases of children, the impacts on children, particularly as a start. And later on, we saw some of the kids even die because of cancers and leukemias, very high incidence in that area. So it's absolutely shocking. But we took 10 years to fight this case. I was not alone. I was assisted by two fantastic public interest lawyers too. A famous Dato' Gurial Singh Nija, who many people know. And of course, there's also Mohidin Abdul Kadir, who's now the current president of the Consumers Association of Penang. So we're all lawyers and we were fighting this case in a big way. And so, and the people, for us, the most encouraging part of this were the people of Bukit Merah. Every time the High Court had this hearing happened, they would close all their little cottage industry. You know, they would be shoemakers or noodle makers or sellers, you know, or whatever of little things in the market. They would shut down their business and they will walk 6 kilometers to come to the 6 miles or 6 kilometers now. Anyway, they would walk to the Ipoh High Court and they would stay there and watching the case. And then we had support from the Japanese lawyers and the Japanese parliamentarians, and there would be demonstrations in front of Mitsubishi Chemicals in Tokyo. We had US lawyers who actually were helping us in terms of the research, because we had the Asian rare earth being assisted by somebody from Johns Hopkins University, and we our US lawyers helped us in showing, exposing how that particular so-called expert was actually very biased in terms of a very pro-radiation. So we actually, this actually led to a worldwide setting up of what was called Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide, which actually inspired the group to come together so that you could support young lawyers like us around the world who don't have the resources like these big corporations do, where they can hire and pay money and bring in, you know, top-notch people from all over the world, and we have absolutely no resources for that. And so this was how, and that Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide continues till today, helping lawyers around the world, particularly in the Global South, to do what they do. So it's been an amazing experience. This story is really a story that many people don't know. Like you were a very young child running around at that time.
Yes.
But this is one of the best environmental cases. We've written a book about this. It's available in the Consumers Association of Penang's website. We have it in all languages. It's a fantastic case. It's our story to tell about how the residents arose to fight. And some of the community leaders were also were detained under the Internal Security Act, apart from me. So it wasn't just me, and I was in solitary confinement for only 47 days. Mm. They served the full 60 days of solitary and then were in house arrest for 2 years after that.
2 years?
Yeah.
With no charges.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mina, I'm just going to go for one quick break. But when we come back, I hope that for you to expand on that experience of, you know, being detained under the ISA. I'm speaking today to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia, head of programs at the Third World Network. It's another episode of Good Things where we speak to good people doing good things, just like Mina here. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Good Things on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Good Things is, of course, the show where we speak to good people doing good things. Our good person today is Meenakshi Raman, the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's also the head of programs at the Third World Network. Before the break, Mina was sharing how she got into social work and, you know, her activism, how she uses her law training background to fight cases, you know, public interest cases. And you told us, you know, earlier about the rare earth one. And of course, you know, I mean, you were never charged for anything. You were, of course, detained under the ISA, the Internal Security Act, back in 1987, under that infamous Ops Lalang. 47 days, you mentioned you were in solitary confinement. I mean, tell me about, you know, what sort of led up to your detainment. You know, did you have any sort of suspicions that you were being monitored? You know, did you know that, you know, you were under surveillance pretty much?
Not at that time, no. But once I was detained, then when I was told about how, you know, what did you do? And we know you did this and we know you do that. And then I realized that the level of surveillance was actually quite high. Mm. And but one of the things that I used to suspect is, you know, you will have some kind of on the phone when you speak. Those times it wasn't about mobile. It was the normal lines and you could hear some kind of recording in the background.
Really?
So it was something. Yes, yes. It was very, very, very obvious to us. And then when we used to go to like in CAP, the Consumers Association of Penang or Sahabat Alam, when we used to go for programs with communities, the special branch would be there. And you could easily know that they are special branch. One, they would introduce themselves to you, or they would come in their very shiny shoes. And then we'll know, yes, they are special branch officers. And
shiny
we had nothing to hide, because we were talking, I mean, to communities who were having problems and environmental battles and so on. And so we were not doing anything unlawful. Mm. But when the detention happened, of course, it was at a time when, you know, the white paper to the Ops Lalang, I'm not going to go into details of that, but it was quite clear that we had nothing to do with all the racial tensions that were brewing around that time. Mm-hmm. Many of us in the NGO arena happened to be picked up because as an excuse, because we did not contribute to any racial tension at all.
Yeah.
It was political infighting and so on and so forth, but not us. So it was a convenient excuse for the authorities then to just round us up. Mm-hmm. And so then there was actually a very difficult moment, as you can imagine. I think I was the youngest detainee. But I had already prepared myself, not about detention, but it so happened that many years ago before that, Syed Hussein Ali, I think Dr. Syed Hussein Ali, many people might know,
yes,
the Socialist Party then, and he was picked up in the 1970s. I think it was during the Baling, after the Baling incident and so on. So I happened to be on a trip with him and I was casually asking him about his detention experience. And he said that it was, you know, he was explaining to me, giving me, I mean, you know, just basically his experience. And what he told me during that time became very useful when I was detained. You know, how you keep yourself occupied, how you would be torn down, how your family would be told that you are, you know, you are breaking down and this and that. So it's really a mentally challenging time. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, you know, that sort of prepared me for any eventuality. But of course, when you are really in the, you know, experience, there's nothing like it. Mm-hmm. I think my faith pulled me through because that's the only hope that you have. That there is someone bigger than you to watch over you. And I was really worried about my family, my father and my mother in particular. My father was a very, you know, had all kinds of illnesses. He had a heart issue. He was asthmatic. His health was not very good. So I was always very worried when I was, you know, in the 47 days that anything might happen to him. And so that was my biggest worry and fear. But after I was released, I realized that the family was much more stronger. My mother was more political. She had never even bothered to be questioning these things. And she said, why you take away my daughter who's doing good things,
wow,
you know? And so it was a really very eye-opening. And even the special branch went to talk to my father. Hmm. They said that, you know, because there was this notion that, you know, we were communist, that we were all involved with pursuing communist ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, one of the questions asked to my father was, why is your daughter just helping the poor? So my father turned back and said to him, well, if helping the poor is being communist, then I am also a communist, my father said.
Oh, my God.
Because,
word.
I mean, all religions talk about, yes, how you help the poor. Even Christ said that, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth and you should work with the poor. And even, you know, the prophet Muhammad and all that, all the religions actually talk about helping the poor. So are we all communists because of that? So it really blew my father's mind that they would say these kind of things. But my family was amazing. They were very supportive. And most of all, I think I must also acknowledge the role of Mesa Muhammad Idris, who was to all of us a father. And in fact, when I was picked up at the CAP office, when the police came to pick me up then that evening, as I was walking back, my friend knew that I was, my office colleague saw the police pick me up. And so he quickly went back and told Mr. Idris, who happened to be in the office and who was about to go and pray, that Mina has been picked up by the police. And then my father called Mr. Idris, and Mr. Idris told my father, you know, I'm sorry to say your daughter has been detained and so on. But my father was amazing and told Mr. Idris, well, ever since she joined the Consumers Association of Penang, she is your daughter. So, you know, you and she's in good hands, and let's see what we can do for her. So I think that kind of parental support, the SM Muhammad Idris and his whole, you know, I mean, he was apparently on the list of to be detained, but because he was too old, they didn't pick him up.
Oh,
my late husband, Martin Kaur, he was on the list, but he happened to be overseas. So they did not pick him up. So anyway, so these are all of us. And
so you, the youngest at the time, or one of the youngest in the group, was the one that was picked, lah?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But maybe the one other thing that I'd like to say is that as a lawyer, and you study the Constitution, you study fundamental rights, and then you are picked up, and there's this law that is preventive detention without trial. I mean, you say, you know, all the legal education in the world is makes you helpless now because you can't even defend yourself with this kind of outrageous law, which got repealed. But of course, we still have SOSMA and other laws that actually allow preventive detention. So it was a fantastic eye-opening experience. And after that, I'm not afraid of anything. Anybody can pick me up if they want.
So that's interesting, right? I mean, it just spurred you on. It didn't have any sort of effect that maybe the authorities had hoped that it would, you know, stop you from helping the poor, because clearly that's the biggest crime in the world, isn't it? My goodness me.
Exactly. I mean, working with the poor and fighting for environmental rights and people's, it's outrageous. Totally outrageous.
Oh, gosh. But I mean, of course, after that, you continued to do, you know, all the work that you did. I mean, Sahabat Alam Malaysia, you are the president. I mean, how did you get from there? You know, how did you start working more on environmental issues? You know, why was that something that's close to your heart?
Yeah, because I think the Consumers Association of Penang was focusing also on the environment at the time together with consumer issues. Mm-hmm. But they decided that they need to have a fully dedicated Friends of the Earth, Sahabat Alam Malaysia. And so many, and in the work that we were doing as young lawyers, we were very inspired by, like I said, the fights of communities. Fishermen standing up against pollution, farmers who were being poisoned in Kuala Kedah because of pesticide usage, agrochemicals, which were, and you could see, them being badly affected with all kinds of diseases on their legs. Rubber tappers, women in the plantations who were exposed to pesticides. And so we began to get involved with all these, communities. And then we could see the environmental link, the lack of laws, or even if there were laws, they were inadequate, and the lack of protection for people. And so that actually inspired both me and my colleagues to work with the Consumers Association Penang and Sahabat Alam Malaysia. And over the years, we have contributed our life. It actually is it's like a marriage to these organizations. I mean, we grew up with these organizations. They're amazing because we also have gone international with the Third World Network.
Yes.
From the grassroots struggles to the national struggles to connecting it to climate change internationally. And we see the system as it is. And I think the understanding of what's happening around the world, it connects with the reality of the day, whether it's the food you eat, how safe it is, whether it's the air quality, or whether the lack of water or the floods that hit you and you can't operate. So we are very thankful. I'm very thankful that this job doesn't, I'm not schizophrenic. You know, sometimes people go to work, they do one piece of work, they come home and they looking at environment or whatever is a hobby, but no, for us, it is our life and our job. And so there is this interconnectedness. We are what many of the Friends of the Earth, people say, we live the life we ought to lead. So in a sense, it's total satisfaction and contentment that we are able to contribute and do something for Mother Earth as well as for the poor. And so it's been an amazing journey.
Has it ever felt, though, I mean, like the things that you were mentioning that, you know, early in your career you were dealing with, you're still dealing with it now, even, you know, all these same issues on food security, you know, fishermen, you know, facing off with the government. I mean, these are things that we've spoken about just in the last couple of years. So these sorts of issues are still persisting, right? Have you ever felt like you're constantly facing, I don't know, impossible odds? Any of those sorts of feelings?
We are like firefighting all the time,
yes.
From before even now. And, you know, we are waiting for more changes to happen. But I think we understand the system that we deal with. And we call the system that industrial capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. We see the system as it is. It's all about grow. And it's all about profits. And it's all about not people and not the planet. I mean, to put it simply, I mean, they are cliches sometimes, but they really mean a deep thing. So who is driving this development? It's not the politicians who are driving the decision makers. It's the model, the path, the corporate behavior or misbehavior, as the case may be. You know, I mean, it's the corporate greed and the lack of attention to you know, a different kind of consumption and production system, mm-hmm. A different production system, which is conscious of how it treats the environment, you know, irrational consumption that we are going on, using more and more of, we talk about plastics, but beyond plastics, why do we need all, I come back to my famous Birkin bags. Why do we need the Birkin bags? Why do we need the massive big cars? Why do we need those big superstory bungalows and unaffordable houses? I mean, it's ridiculous. So the earth is limited, as we have always said. I mean, we have limited resources, and this is living simply so that others simply live is really very deep. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you feel that you're fighting a big war, you know, mm-hmm. It's true. But I think knowing that we are fighting a huge system, you know, is something that says, you know, we are not naive. We are not here because we think we're going to solve the problem today or tomorrow. It's a long haul. But I must say that, people ask, what is the hope? Why do you continue to do it? Where is the hope coming from?
Yeah.
And I'm always inspired by local communities. I mean, I don't say this as cliche, but they are in the front line of the struggles. Whether the fisher folk in the front line of the Penang South Reclamation Project, whether it's those communities fighting to protect their children and their grandchildren's generation from a radio, the biggest radioactive waste facility, which is going to be sited in by the Linus Waste in Kuantan,
yeah.
Whether it is the indigenous peoples fighting to protect the forest, they are all in the front. And they are the inspiration. They are the front lines, and we are there to support that effort so that there is another world possible. There is another alternative, and we have to learn to find that and live with hope despite all the odds.
And Mina, you've worked on so many cases, you know, as you said, you know, you go on the international front, you know, and negotiating, there's, you know, so much of work that you've been doing throughout these years. What would you say is one of the successes that you're most proud of? I mean, you spoke about the rare earth one earlier, but, you know, anything else that, you know, you're really proud of?
Penang Hill, saving Penang Hill. I think that was one of the most exciting battles as well.
Yeah.
Very proud to tell that story of how the community of Penang, the children of Penang, I mean, this was actually the Consumers Association of Penang together with Sabat Alam Malaysia. And then we had other organizations like Aliran, Malayan Nature Society, the University Academy Association, USM, all of them, all of us coming together, forming what's called Friends of Penang Hill. And that was because we believed that Penang Hill, I mean, we love Penang Hill. And then, you know, looking at the environmental impact assessment and seeing how it was really very flawed assessment, using that public participatory process that was allowed under the law to critique the environmental impact assessment. And then working with the Director General of Environment, Dr. the Datuk Abubakar Jaffa, really, really a fantastic person, who was listening to paying attention to what civil society was saying. He even roped us into the committee to review the EIA. And now it is actually NGOs can sit on EIA review committees, but he paid attention. He listened and he interrogated and he looked at it. And at the end of the day, the EIA was rejected. And because the EIA was rejected, then the Penang government at that time, under Dato' Lim Chong Yew, this whole Penang Hill issue became a political issue. And we had children and mothers and fathers, save Penang Hill, don't destroy. And, you know, we had postcards that came from everyone to say, save Penang Hill, don't kill Penang Hill. And the DOE, the Department of Environment, was flooded with thousands of postcards.
Amazing.
That's an amazing story. And then Lim Chong Yew lost, you know, he, a very big, formidable man. He lost his seat, and the new chief minister at that time, Dr. Koh Soo Koon, took over. And then he convened a meeting the state exco, and we all went and explained again and what the problems were. And then they saw, my God, you know, if Penang Hill was not saved by this big Disney project, that it's almost Disney kind of project that they were, the Berjaya Corporation at that time was planning up on that hill, Penang would be in deluge of floods today, even much worse than what we experience now. So I think that is a part, that's something that I'm very proud of in terms of how groups in Penang and the people of Penang stood up against this massive project that was there. And of course, the latest was the Ulu Langat campaign, the forest reserve in Ulu Langat, and all the coalitions and so on, how we actually managed to stop the de-gazetting of the Ulu Langat forest reserve. Yeah, you have had people talk about this. So these are victories that coming from the ground up, and many more like this.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing from you is that collaboration that's so important. Is that all of, you know, everyone coming together and making that voice that heard, isn't it?
Yes, it's absolutely. It's about the green consciousness, the green awareness from the ground. It's about people mobilizing and agitating for change. I think it is that kind of drive that will make the difference. And unfortunately, it seems like we are firefighting, but it has to translate to better laws, better policies, better governance, better transparency, and so on. So we also have to work at that level and also use the law where wrongdoing is done, which we are doing, you know, in many of our cases.
Okay. All right. We're just going to go for one more quick break, Mina. When we come back, I'm just going to ask you some more about some of the challenges that remain. I'm speaking today to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's the head of programs at Third World Network. This is another episode of Good Things, and we're finding out all about Mina's story as an activist. We'll have more after one more quick break. You're listening to Good Things on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Good Things on The Bigger Picture, the show where we speak to good people doing good things. Meenakshi Raman, the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia and the head of programs at Third World Network, has been doing plenty of good things, you know, in her 40-year career as an activist. She's also a trained lawyer, and she's been sharing her story with us today. So, Mina, I mean, before that, you know, before this second break, you told us all about some of those great successes, right? But of course, challenges still remain. Global deadline to address accelerated warming. That's something that we always talk about on Earth Matters. That's, you know, rapidly approaching. Are you optimistic that the global community can sufficiently address this problem? I mean, where do you see the most, I guess, room for improvement?
This is one of the areas that is most difficult and very, you know, challenging. Because as I pointed out before, what we saw in Glasgow, it was actually not going far enough.
Yeah.
I mean, we have talked before about pledges which are too little, too late, particularly by the rich world. And the fossil fuel companies are still, you know, very much there. Look at the Ukraine war. I mean, what energy prices have gone up.
Yeah.
You know, the Western world now is grappling with new oil. And so they are asking for the pumping of more oil from other countries because they can't depend on Russia. So you think that, emissions going down? No, they're going up. And war, of course, will never lead to emissions going down. It will go up. So and the energy prices, particularly now coal has become cheap because of the oil and gas, which has become expensive. Mm. So if you just look in the last 2 weeks about the oil crisis and coal and the revival of coal, I mean, in Glasgow, they were all clapping and saying, we're going to phase out coal and blah, blah, but see what's happening today. So I'm not really that optimistic because I think that the realization is that the whole global economy is very, very addicted to fossil fuels. And to get us out of that, it will really require huge effort. And there is actually a coalition called the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Groups of people are calling for a global treaty. But we are saying that you can't have a treaty which doesn't actually acknowledge the challenges of the poor in developing countries who have no alternatives to renewables. Mm. So like the fight that was in Glasgow with India and China, and India particularly saying that much of their energy poor are still dependent on coal. And then if you talk about the removal of fossil fuel subsidies, the first people who will be burdened by them are the poor. So we have to make sure that we don't burden them. And the Minister of Finance in the news about fossil fuel subsidies and how we need to remove them because with the rise of prices, yeah. Subsidies are also going up. So I do think that this is a difficult issue. It's not easy. So therefore, how do you do this transformation that requires... The problem is we don't have much time. It's not like we have 20, 30 years down the line. We don't have that kind of time. We have a fast closing window, like about 10 years, maximum 15, maybe, mm-hmm. before we actually cross a lot of the tipping points that the scientists are predicting when the temperature already goes beyond 1.5 degrees limit from pre-industrial era. 1.1 we are seeing, you know, everybody is complaining about the floods in KL and this and that and why it's happening so often and landslides being triggered and people dying. So much more of this is going to happen. So in that sense, I think the problem is really enormous. And it's not a problem that Malaysia can solve alone, as I've said 100 times, because it really requires global response. But with this big war between the West and Russia and the continued and China, mm-hmm. with the competitiveness rather than cooperation, real global cooperation, we don't see global cooperation at this time. It's a very hostile environment. And so it's very, very sad. Like even on the pandemic, you know, on the COVID vaccines, even in the most essential, I mean, the pandemic was killing people and everybody is connected and we're all going to be suffering. And still you don't, the rich world doesn't allow the manufacture and production of vaccines in the developing world. So you can see it's really, they sometimes I ask myself, do they have any humanity at all? Or is it only white lives matter? You know, the rest of the us can go. You look at the migration issue or the of refugee issue, even from the Ukrainian crisis.
Yeah.
You know, the difference in treatment between those who are Ukrainians and those who are non. You know, and it just shows you that it is deeply racist. It is deeply embedded in strong, powerful interests. In you know. And so those who preach human rights are actually not doing what is right in terms of saving the poor who cannot have access to vaccines. So a lot of double standards. And so I'm not, no. At the global level, I think the situation is pretty bleak. And on the same side, we don't see the leadership from the South, from the global South, which is coming together in very powerful way. We don't see that either. It's a very deeply divided global South as well. So we are going through some very difficult times, the pandemic, the climate crisis, you know, the much more difficult, you know, financial crisis, which is also unfolding. So I do think that we're in difficult times. But for the young people who are listening, I mean, I don't want to sound so hopeless, gloom and doom and you know, in that sense. But yeah. I would like to say that... you know, as a young activist, when I started getting involved in this, the one hope that kept going that I'm not alone, that I'm not the only one, that this world, if this world means a lot to me, if another world is possible, then I have to be part of that change with the growing number of people around the world that have to be doing similar things. And even whether it's from your home to your neighborhood, to your community, to your state, to your national level and then international. So there's a lot of opportunity for activism to keep the hope alive. And I think that's what I wanted to say. One of our challenges in the environmental movement is that not many are, you know, many of us are not going to be there forever. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm already, if you want to know how old I am, I'm already 64 this year.
Okay.
We'd like to see more young people join the bandwagon. We'd like to see more young lawyers dedicated to these kind of causes. We would like to see more support from the public to donate. The philanthropy is a bit missing in this country for this kind of work. There's a lot of people who give money to orphanages and charities and religious foundations, but very few, far and few, actually support, for instance, by saying, okay, Mina, here is this amount of money for Sabah Alam Malaysia and the Consumers Association of Penang. We are all struggling for funds. And so even if people sit in the home and you say every month I will, or every year I, here I am donating this X of money for you, we will be very happy to accept the donation. I mean, I'm not here for a public appeal, but I'm trying to say that there are challenges and there's a lot that needs to continue to be done. And so for people listening out there, in any way that that you can be part of this journey for a better world, and which must, because at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, are we part of the problem or are we part of the solution?
And, you know, as you also say so many times, the climate crisis is a crisis that will affect everybody. As you said as well, we are already seeing the effects today. You know, it's no point us asking, gosh, why is this happening? We know why it's happening. And, you know, we should support everybody who's trying to fight against this. And yeah, we need to be part of the solution, not the problem, as you said.
Yes, thank you, Juliet. And I can see you always as part of Earth Matters. Really, the Earth does matter.
It does. It does. Hopefully, yeah. You know, more people. The aim is to get more people interested. But
yes,
thank you so much, Mina, for joining me today and for sharing all those stories. And of course, you know, if people are interested to help or to find out how they can donate or support the work that you do, they just need to head to foe-malaysia.org. That's Sabah Alam's website. There's also Third World Network at twn.my and consumer.org.my for the Consumers Association of Penang. My thanks again to my guest today. I've been speaking to Meenakshi Rahman, President of Sabah Alam Malaysia and Head of Programs at the Third World Network. This has been Good Things on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.